nice to see some of you that we didn't see in the morning session. I know it was getting a little long there. So everybody, I hope there's a little rest. That was a great dinner, wasn't it? That was a really good dinner. You know, I love doing these. I love being at these. This is a particularly wonderful location. I think I mentioned this before, that I've been to retreat centers all over this country, and this is a particularly beautiful one. It's just a setting that is just heavenly, just heavenly. We have been talking about the problem of compulsive overeating. We have been talking about, in our last session, steps 3 and 4, which are the most misunderstood steps. Steps 3 and 4 have forever been the most misunderstood steps because we try to overthink things and we try to over-engage our brains, and our lack of understanding is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. My confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. And the book lays it out so simply that I think in our zeal to overthink things and reinvent the wheel, we tend to take it, the fourth step, and make it into something which it is not. It is, at its base level, a system of inventorying our resentments. Who or what do we resent? What did they do to us? What part of self is affected, and what did we do to get them all in motion? Now, for some of us, as we covered today, there are some resentments that we had nothing to do with. Perhaps you have been molested. Perhaps you have been raped. Perhaps you have been abandoned. Perhaps you have been a victim of some form of abuse. Perhaps you have been a victim of a crime. What did you do to bring that about? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But I have to ask myself a question. What is the payoff to this resentment? What is the payoff to hanging on to this resentment? The payoff is I no longer have to take responsibility for my own life, and I can live in hell, and to live in the Kit Kat bars, and to live in the Doritos, the Raisinets, and the ice cream is a living hell. Because to hold on to that resentment means I no longer have to take any work to do it. I no longer have to take responsibility. It's time for me to let it go. It's time for me to step out into the sunlight of the Spirit. We do the same thing with our fears. What do we fear? Why do we fear it? What part of self is affected? What did I do to bring that about? And then we took our sex inventory. Who did we hurt? What did we do to them or not do for them? What part of self is affected? What character defects caused us to take or omit the action in column 2? And the fifth column is, what should we have done instead? And we do our sexual ideal. And I talked to you in the last session about my sexual ideal as being the adult in the relationship. And also, I will never be in another relationship where I have to walk on eggshells. If I have to walk on eggshells around you, then this is not the relationship for me. I have to be able to be comfortable in that relationship. Now, what are we going to do with this? And what did we essentially accomplish in step 4? We created a beginning, not an end in and of itself. And I can't count the number of people I have sponsored through the years where we did our fifth step, and they're done with the fifth step, and they're not magically cured, and so I never hear from them again. The fifth step is a step in 12, and this is a process which goes on through our whole life. And in our fourth step, we uncover, discover, and discard. We uncover who we are. Excuse me, we uncover the nature of our problem. We discover who we really are, and we discard the defects of character in 6 and 7 that have been killing us from the time we were born. Excuse me, sorry about that. There's going to be a lot of nose blowing on the tape. I apologize for that. To the listeners and to John. Okay. Let's go to the bottom of page 75. And finding someone to take our fifth step is not as complicated an issue in 2014 as it might have been in 1937, 38, and 39. There are plenty of people around that can take a fifth step. What is it that I want to make sure that I have in a fifth step person? I have someone who's informed, so they know how to point out my part in the fourth column, and I have someone who's unaffected. Let's just say, for the sake of this particular scenario, that I am friendly with Don B. of San Diego. And I happen to know that Dave B. is also friendly with Don B. of San Diego. And I have been friends with Don for a long time. But what if I had resentments against Don that I know are on my fourth step? Would I go to Dave B. to do a fifth step? Absolutely not. I go to somebody who is informed and yet uninvolved. Now, obviously, I have resentments against Bob. We know this. We've covered this. We know this. That's just the way it goes. But so I would seek out someone who is informed and yet not involved in Bob's life so that I can give this to him and both of us can be highly objective. Let's go to the bottom of 75. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. For we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimmed on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? If we can answer to our satisfaction, now this is how quickly you start to move through the steps. This is how quickly it happens. And there are a lot of OA myths that I want to smash, and we all want to smash. And that is, you work a step a year, you work a step every month. What a bunch of nonsense. You turn the page and you're already at step 6. Now step 6 and 7, before we continue, are 2 short little paragraphs. But here is what we're talking about. I have seen the terrible destructiveness of my self-seeking and my fear and my anger and my dishonesty and my selfishness. I have seen the terrible destructiveness of my defects of character. And what do you see when you do a fourth step? And what do you hear when you do a fifth step? You hear patterns. Selfish, 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 fear, 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 dishonest. You see these patterns. And the patterns that I see are, I am a very scared man who wants the world to stick to my script. I am a very dishonest man. I'm a very, very angry man. And I have a lot of anger in me, and I didn't really know that. But if you think about it, what you do to yourself with food, would your brain keep seeking this out if that anger wasn't triggering all the time? No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. You know, the jolly fat man doesn't exist. So let's take a look at these defects of character. And in steps 6 and 7, we're now going to take the program out of the laboratory and bring it into our lives. Now, I own my own business. Can I operate my business honestly? Can I operate my business without anger? Can I operate my business without fear? Can I go into my life and have relationships with men and women that are healthy, that are not born out of manipulation and selfishness and self-seeking? Can I call a person a friend even though there's no other motivation there? Can I love and be loved? Can I be one of many? Because ego is conscious separation from the group. We don't just ease God out, we ease ourselves out. And when I go into the world, I know how to look up at you, and I know how to look down at you. And I have a very sensitive assessment machine in my head. And that assessment machine in my head will size you up in a minute, and it will either say to me, you are better than me, or you are a stupid idiot and you're worse than me. You're lower than the Cubs win-loss record. And when I make that assessment, I am playing God. But it says in the big book, we must quit playing God. But once I assess that you're better than me, I can now revere you. I can now look up to you in hopes that somehow, some way, you're going to take care of me. And somehow, some way, maybe some of your wealth, your greatness, your fame, your talent will rub off on me. That somehow, because I'm associated with you, maybe people will think I'm pretty good too. Or I know how to assess you and think to myself, you're an idiot and I'm better than you. You know what? Neither one are true. Humility is the God-given blessing in my life that allows me to look at you and appreciate your humanity. That you are a child of God. That you are a person. That you have great validity and great worth in the larger tapestry of the world that we live in. And it is not up to me to assess you. It is not up to me to judge you. It is not up to me to put you in a category. Humility, not humiliation, allows me to be another bozo on the bus. It allows me to be one of many. And we're going to talk about steps 6 and 7. And we see this word, humble. Humble. It allows me to be one of the group. What a gift it is that I no longer have to be better or worse, but one of. One of. Page 76 at the very top. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. It's a very, very easy instruction. I'm afraid to give up my fear. I'm afraid to give up my anger, my selfish, self-seeking, and dishonesty. Why? They may not be much, but they're the only weapons I've ever taken with me into the nuclear war of compulsive overeating. It's almost as if I had a stick here, or I'll use this pen, and I have this pen. And outside is England, America, Canada, Israel, Japan, Germany, France, Italy, the armies and navies of China and Russia and everything else, and they have declared war on me. But I'm going to go out there with my stick, and I'm going to smite them with my stick. And some of you are laughing, and some of you are sleeping. But the ones of you that are laughing are thinking to yourself, what a ridiculous scenario I have just painted about going into all these armies with my stick. But isn't that exactly what I try to do every day? And I took my little willpower out into the world, and there was the donut shop, and there was the Taco Bell, and there was McDonald's, and there was fear, and there was dishonesty and self-seeking, and I'm trying not to gravitate back to the fast food restaurant, and I'm trying not to eat Kit Kat bars because I got my stick. And my stick lost every battle. My stick lost every battle, but I'm not letting go of my stick. Because my stick was the only weapon I had. My lying, my self-seeking, my selfishness, my anger. This was the only weapon I had to go out into the world and not ruin more Kit Kat bars lives. Every morning when I woke up, all the Kit Kat bars would be trembling, knowing that their life expectancy had dwindled to minutes. Every Raisinette box. I used to open up those Raisinette boxes, I'd be drunk before I could get them in my mouth, and I could set an indoor speed record for dumping them down my throat. Almond Joys, I used to, oh my God, and Butterfingers and all the rest of it. It's a good thing that in chapter 7 it says any attempt to removing alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure, because another thing I get calls and letters, why do you have to always mention food? Because any attempt to remove the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. Let's face the fact, it says whiskey and bourbon and gin and beer in the big book. It talks about sedatives, and it talks about whiskey, and my gin would last longer than his preaching. It's all over the book. It's all over the book. Okay. When ready, we say something like this. Now, if you're ready to let go of your defects, say this with me. And if you're sitting next to somebody who's asleep, don't say it too loudly, but say it with me. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have completed step 7. Now, in my 35 years in program, every single time I believe I have gone to a step meeting where we talk about amends, whether we're talking about step 8 or 9, the conversation will ignore 8 and go right to 9. We do not talk about step 8 very much. But step 8 is going to get talked about tonight because it is a very definite step unto itself. Because I must be willing to make these amends. And what step am I really going to rely on here as I venture out to clean up the past of my misdeeds? I'm going to rely on step 2. And where you see people who are reticent to make amends, where you see people who are reticent to go out and face the people that they have harmed, you are seeing people that are not really solid in their step 2 work. Step 2 is going to be the step stool that I'm going to use. I must have that foundation. And I like that metaphor of the step stool because I need to reach for something that I can't get to quite on my own. And that is recovery. I can't get to the recovery on my own. So I need a step stool. And the foundation of that step stool is going to be step 2. But I must be willing. Let's look at the step. And then I want to talk to you about how this step manifested in my life, and maybe you can relate to it. It says, we have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. And that's one of the other things you'll see in OA. People say we burn our inventory. For God's sakes, don't burn anything. Number one, you're going to start a fire. And number two, you need the inventory, or how are you going to go out and make amends to people that you've harmed, that you've had these ill feelings towards, if you don't have your 4-step inventory in front of you? We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, here we're going to refer back to step 0. It was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Now, there are people in my life that I couldn't make amends to. One of the people that I couldn't make amends to was my mother, because she died before I came to my first meeting. My father died before I came to my first meeting. And there were people that I harmed that I cannot make amends to because I don't know where they are and I cannot find them. Even with the immense resources that I have at my disposal that Bill and Bob and the original 100 and all the early AAs had at their disposal, they didn't have Google and they didn't have LinkedIn and Facebook and all this other stuff. But I had a lot of amends to make to people that had passed away before I came into these rooms. Now, when I was a little boy, I saw my father be as abusive to my mother as you could be without taking out a gun and killing her. My mother was mentally ill, and I blamed her and her mental illness for everything that went wrong in my life. And I went around thinking that I hated her guts. And I wish that I could have Robin Laura Petrie for parents, but I got Max and Virginia Grabowski, which is something about 180 degrees away from Robin Laura Petrie. If you don't know who Robin Laura Petrie are, Google them too. I can't teach you everything. Okay. My mother was a sick person, and I blamed her for everything. I have a very distinct memory when I was 10 years old. 1964, I was 10 years old, and McDonald's ran a big advertising campaign that they were going to start staying open all year long. But if you came in during the summer of 64, you could get a license plate for your bicycle. And if you came in and you got a license plate for your bicycle, that seemed to me to be the coolest thing you could possibly have, is a license plate from McDonald's for your bike. And me and my friend Alan and my three David friends, and I had another friend whose name was Joel, and another friend whose name was Mark, and we went down to McDonald's. And Mark and Joel and the Davids and Alan, they got their McDonald's license plates. And I couldn't have a McDonald's license plate because they didn't have Harlan. And I came home in tears. And at that moment, I thought that not having a license plate for McDonald's, for my bicycle, was about as horrible a tragedy as one could be asked to suffer. I mean, how much can one deal with in life, like not having a license plate for your bike? And I came home, and it was a Friday, and I was in tears. And my mother called. She was in Bethesda Hospital in Chicago with pneumonia. Now, pneumonia in 1964 was a little different than it is today. You had an oxygen tent in place, and you had all kinds of medical situations in place. And she was quite ill at that time. And I was going to wait for my dad to come home from his sausage route, and we were going to go see my mother at the hospital. I picked up the phone, and it was my mother. And I told her through my tears that I hate you, and I hope you die, because you gave me that effed up name, and I hate that name, and why did you have to effing name me that, and I hate you, and I hope you die. Now, my mother, being a Jewish mother, didn't miss a beat, and said, why are you going to McDonald's? I left you frozen hamburger in the freezer. Why did you go with me, Frost? She didn't miss a beat. But anyway, now, this was in the days way before cell phones. It would be another 30-something years before I ever got a cell phone. And she knew how to catch up with my dad on his route. She kept calling delis and restaurants that he would be at to deliver, and she finally caught up with him. And he's coming up the back steps, and now we're going to have a problem, because if I'm making a problem for him with my crazy mother by yelling at her and telling her I want her to die, he's going to make a problem for me because shit goes downhill. So he's all mad. My mother's all upset, and I remember this very, very distinctly, and this was a big hullabaloo over nothing. Over absolutely nothing. And I remember that when my mother died, I never really believed that we would ever have the beautiful relationship that was to happen. Now, I came into the program in 1979, and from 1979 to 1994, it took me, 20-some years? Right? 79 to 89 is 10, 89 to 94 is 15. It took me 15 years in program to come to the conclusion that I did not choose my mother. I didn't choose her. She was chosen for me. And I came to some modicum of peace in those 15 years. And then something very, very special happened on December the 14th. 1994. It was in Eugene, Oregon, and my daughter, Hannah, was born, and she was 5 pounds, 8 ounces, and she was born on the 14th of December, 1994, at 4:27 p.m. at Sacred Heart Hospital. My daughter was born under some very extraordinary conditions. My ex-wife was highly ill during her pregnancy. My wife lost about 26 pounds during pregnancy and had hyperemesis gravis. Hyperemesis gravis means you vomit constantly. You know that thing, morning sickness? It was the kind of morning sickness that lasted all day long. And this is what she had. She was hospitalized through most of her pregnancy, very near death. My daughter was born, and they told us before she was born that she might be blind and deaf with cerebral palsy and developmentally delayed. And I said, got anything else? I mean, as long as we're going for the whole package, why don't we take the luxury suite? But anyway, we're 3,000 miles from home, and this is what the social worker at Sacred Heart Hospital is telling us. And my daughter was born, and they brought her into the other room, and the nurse, her name is Janice, I can see her now, she cleaned off my daughter and said, it does not appear baby is blind. And I thank God. And then it said, she said, I don't think she's deaf either. I said, thank God. And they said, would you like to carry your daughter into the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit? And the nurse and the other doctor said, are you sure you're up to this? And I said, yes, I want to carry her. I'm fine. I'm really okay. So I carried her into the neonatal intensive care unit at Sacred Heart Hospital. And when they give medication to an infant, they don't come in through the arm like they would on you. It goes in through the feet and the head. And it's not an incubator anymore. It's a, I can't remember what they call it now. It's not an incubator. It's something else. But anyway, they put her into this isolate or something. I think my finger just went off. Let's just see what we did here. Low battery. Yeah, move the recorder thing.
Yep.
Can you all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, just move that and we'll be fine. And if I march around, I'll carry it with me.
See if I can get it up.
Okay. So my daughter was born, and I brought her into the NICU at Sacred Heart Hospital, and they put the medicine into the head and the feet. And I saw her thrashing around, and all of a sudden, I got it. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, I know how much I hurt you now, Mom. I understand how much I hurt you, and I really did love you. I just was too sick and too crazy and too nuts to be able to show you that I loved you, but I did love you. And from that moment on, I stopped thinking about how much I didn't choose my mother, and I started thinking about how much my mother didn't choose her mental illnesses either. That if my mother could have had her way, she would have given me Laura Petrie. If my mother could have given me Laura Petrie, Dinah Shore, whatever, she would have done it. There was nothing that my mother possessed that she would not give me. She was a loving, generous woman. She was a kind woman. She was a woman who would have given me the skin off of her back. And she didn't become mentally ill in some plot to thwart my life. She became mentally ill because that was the card that she was dealt. I also had resentments of shame and frustration with my dad. I wanted a father that could have left me a lot of money. I wanted a father that could have given me an inheritance. I wanted a father that could have given me some guidance. But my father came to this country at 14 years of age from the murder and mayhem that cast him on our shores. What kind of parenting did he have? What kind of chance did he have? What was he supposed to pass along to me when he was robbed of being a child too? He lived in murder and mayhem. What was he supposed to pass on except this fear that he had so strongly developed over time? And I started to understand that I loved my mother, and I started to understand that I had to focus not on what I lost out on, but what they lost out on and what the world lost out on, because these were two good people that created my life. These were two wonderful, extraordinary people that did the best they could. And I remember being so jealous of the kids in the neighborhoods that ran and got on airplanes and came to places like California and Arizona and Florida. Well, look at me now. here I am in Santa Barbara, California, and here I am going on airplanes, and here I am traveling the country. It was not to be then, but here I am traveling around, and I probably take more plane trips a year than most of the people that I know. And I come to places like this to be with people like you, and it is a pleasure, and it is a joy. I also did some other things, and I don't have the time to go into everything, but I remember very distinctly when I was 10 or 11 years old. Now remember, I told you that I was on diet pills at that time, so it made me half crazy anyway. We were playing baseball with a rubber ball, and I thought it would be funny if instead of pitching the ball to the batter, I hit one of the kids that was watching us play, and I hit one of them. And everybody did laugh, except little Wendell. And he was 4 years old, and I hit him right in the chest with the ball. And I was 10, and he was 4. And I hurt him. And not only did I hurt him, I embarrassed him in front of everybody. And I wish that my arm would never have done that. And I'm ashamed and embarrassed today that I did that to little Wendell. He was a good little kid. He was a wonderful kid. He was a kid from the neighborhood, lived in my building. The kid never raised a hand to hurt me in his life. And I did that to him. And if I could make amends to him, I would do it in a heartbeat. And I would say, good gosh, I'm so sorry I did that to you. And I wish I could make amends. And there were people that I said rude things to. And there were people that I did rude things to. And there were people that I hurt. And I wish I could make amends to them. But I cannot find them or they're dead. So step 8 for me is a definite, definite step. I want to talk about one other amends, but we'll wait until we get to step 9 on that one. What we're going to talk about here is direct amends, okay? Direct amends. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident, hesitant, about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Now, this sentence tells me why I was born, and this sentence is from an old Oxford group term, being maximum, and they wanted Bill to be maximum. They wanted him to recruit stockbrokers to come into the Oxford group, not the drunks. And Bill says, no, my job is to recruit drunks. Well, what did the stockbrokers have that the drunks didn't have? Money. And they didn't want the drunks, they wanted the stockbrokers. It says here, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the pride ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. But our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. So what we're saying here is we make amends. We don't just apologize. We don't apologize to the Constitution. We amend the Constitution, and that means to change. And that means direct amends to the person. And, you know, if you owe the person money, you pay them. If you can't pay them all at one time, you start making payments. But you don't walk up to somebody and say, gosh, I'm sorry I owe you $60,000. They'll say, I'm sorry you owe me $60,000 too. Where's my money? We start making those payments. And what is it that I need to start making those payments? I need to lean on step 2. Because if I don't have a step 2 in my life, I'm never going to let go of the cash. And I had to make a lot of money amends because in my illness, my food habit was $100, $150 per day. And my food habit got me into trouble with my finances, and I was writing bad checks to anyone stupid enough to take them. And I was lying when the truth would have served me better.
and I wrote tens of thousands of dollars worth of bad checks to people. And we make direct amends. We do not shy away from these things. And I started making these amends, and I didn't want to do it because I wasn't as solid in step two as I should have been or could have been. And I started to do it, and I couldn't pay everybody off at one time. I started making payments after payments after payments after payments, and eventually I got these things whittled down. But there were some amends that I had to make. There were some things that I had to deal with that were not so easy. The government, the federal government in the state of Illinois, contacted my employer that I hadn't paid my taxes in years and that they were going to have to start garnishing my wages. Without a word from me, without a request from me, without anything on my part being done, God did for me what I could not do for myself. And that is, my employer called me in. And his name is Bob. It still is Bob. He called me into his office and he loaned me interest-free thousands and thousands of dollars so I could pay off the government, so I could avoid paying penalties, and I could avoid paying interest on the money. And he loaned me a lot of money. And then he called his friend, the attorney, the guy's name was Sonny. Sonny's gone now. He called his friend Sonny, and Sonny was an attorney, and he was able to plead before the IRS, and he was a very high-line attorney, and he started doing a lot of work for me for free. He never charged me a dime. He did it because of his friendship to Bob, and he cleaned up a lot of my credit, and he got me square with the IRS, and he got me square with the state of Illinois. And it wasn't more than about 6-7 months after all this debacle that I was able to go in and buy a brand new car because of the work that he had done on my behalf. So when I wanted God and I needed God and I walked over to God, he ran to me. He ran to me. But I want to tell you about a special amends that I had to make in a very, very special situation. When I was in my illness, this is about 1982, I went to a dentist, and this dentist was about a block from where I went to high school. I went to Mather High School in Chicago, and this guy's office was at Lincoln in California in Chicago. And I went into his office with a hot tooth. If you don't know what a hot tooth is, it's a tooth is where the nerve is dying. And it hurts and it doesn't hurt. And it hurts and it doesn't hurt. And then it keeps hurting and it doesn't stop hurting. And I had this hot tooth. And, you know, you wait twice when you go to the dentist. You wait outside and then you wait inside. And the hygienist or the nurse or whatever came in and deadened me up and got all the Novocaine in my gum and everything. And I'm ready to go. And the guy comes in and the first thing he said to me, never met me before in his life, he says to me, "My God, how much do you weigh?" He says, "Crap, I just had this chair fixed. It cost me $2,500. He says, "You know, this chair says right on it that the maximum weight is 500 pounds. He says, "You've got to weigh more than 500 pounds. He says, "You can't even fit in this chair." He says, "I'm afraid you're going to break my chair." Now, I'm numb in the jaw, I'm numb in the gum, and I am now numb emotionally because the only thing I know to do in these embarrassing situations is shut down emotionally, and that's what I'm doing at this moment, and I'm going to weather the storm, and I'm going to let him fix the tooth because I got no choice. He's going to do some root canal on it. And I'm shut down emotionally, and damn it, as luck would have it, I broke his chair. As luck would have it, the chair did break, and he started screaming, and he started yelling. And now he's yelling at his daughter that she's never to take an appointment from me ever again, as long as she lives, and that I to have my dental records ready when the appointment is over, because the chair is broken, and he doesn't know what he's going to do to fix it. He fixed my tooth. And eventually, my insurance made their payment, but my copay on that visit was $62. Well, you know what this guy can do for $62. It's not the kind of behavior you want somebody to see in public, but that's what he can do for his $62. I ain't getting no $62 out of here, I'll tell you that. And eventually I start taking four steps, and this guy's on the resentments, and it keeps showing up, and it keeps showing up, and I push it back, and I push it back, and I push it back, and I push it back. And finally there's no more amends to make. I'm paying stuff down. Pretty soon I'm getting close to being even with the house, and I'm making the state of Illinois and the federal government, disappear from my list because they're paid, and I'm paying Bob back the money that he loaned me every time I get a paycheck. And all of a sudden my sponsor taps me on the shoulder and he says to me, "You need to make this amends to Dr. P." I went to Liberty Federal Savings at California and Lincoln. I got a 50, a 10, and 2 1s, $62. This is years later. I go across the street to this guy's office and I see his daughter, but I don't see his name anymore on the door. But I see his daughter is still in there. So I go in there and I introduce myself to the daughter, and she remembered me. And she told me that her father had passed away. And I gave her the $62 and she didn't want to take it. I insisted that she take it. I told her a little bit about why I insisted that she took it, and she understood, and I said, "If you have to, give it to charity, but it is in my best interest, and I ask you to please take the $62. She did. She agreed to take it. My tires did not touch the ground on the way home. The very last thing that I was thinking about was overeating at that moment. The very last thing that was crossing my mind at that moment was food. And I have to think that this program works. And the step that I lean on most heavily in 9 is step number 2. Now, I also want to tell you a little bit about something that is common to every one of us here and every one of us who is not here. We get the impression when we listen to the story of how AA was formulated that Dr. Bob met Phil and remained sober for the rest of his life. Not true. Not true. He met Bill on Mother's Day, May 14th. 1935. And Bob had his reservations for the American Medical Association convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, that was coming up in June. And when Bill met Bob in May, Mother's Day, Ann Smith, while Bill was living in their home on Ardmore Street, 455 Ardmore, I recommend if you can get there, to get there. It's a moving trip. He said to Bill, "Please don't let Bob go. He gets drunk at this convention every year." And Bill said to Ann Smith, "There is nothing I can do to stop him. Bob lives in a world where there's alcohol, and his obsession has either been removed or it has not. We hear advertisements on TV every day for food. We see all the commercials. We hear all the things on the radio, right? But the compulsion has either been removed or it has not." Well, as sure as you're sitting there, Bob leaves for the convention on Thursday before the 10th, which would be 6th of October, I believe. Or, yeah. 6th of June, I mean. Sorry, 6th of June, 7th of June, Thursday? No, 6th. And he goes and he's drunk before the train pulls out of Akron. Oh. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, he's as drunk as drunk can be in Atlantic City. On the 9th of June, Sunday, the 9th of June, Bob returns to Akron and goes drunk to the home of his nurse. His nurse calls Ann Smith and says, "Guess who's at my house drunk?" And Ann says, "We're coming to get him, don't worry." And Bill Wilson and Ann Smith pile into the car and go over to get Dr. Bob. And it is Sunday, June the 9th, 1935. On the 10th of June, 1935, Monday morning, Dr. Bob was a proctologist, and I'm not sure what a procto is, but I'm glad he wasn't operating on my procto that morning. He gets up and he says to Bill, "I can't do this operation. I'm shaking very badly, and I can't do this. I'm going to kill somebody." And Bill Wilson does something for Dr. Bob that a lot of AA sponsees wish their sponsors would do for them. He popped open a beer and gave it to Dr. Bob to settle him down so he could do the surgery. And they made an arrangement to meet in the parking lot of the hospital, Akron City St. Thomas Hospital, after the surgery. And Bill would take Bob home and put him to bed so he could get some rest, and then they would restart their work. This is June the 10th, 1935. No Bob. Never comes out of the hospital after the operation. Bill's waiting out there in the parking lot for hours. He figures that the beer has re-triggered Bob's allergy, and Bob is off to the races again. 12:45 p.m., the night of June the 10th, 1935. Dr. Bob is coming down Ardmore Street, sober as sober can be. He says to Bill that he finally was able to have the faith to go around Akron making restitution, making amends to the people that he had harmed through his drinking. You see, he never had the faith before, step two, he never had the faith before that time to go around Akron making these amends to people that he had harmed because he was too afraid of losing whatever medical practice he had left due to his drinking, and he was afraid of what it would do to his reputation. After he made these amends on June the 10th, 1935, he never found it necessary to ever drink another drop of alcohol again, and save for a few temptations, save for a few fleeting thoughts of alcohol, he never drank again, and he died in 1950. Now I have to think that if it's good enough for Dr. Bob, it's good enough for us. Restitution. Going in and facing these things, unless it's going to harm you or harm another person, you need a sponsor. If you do not have an informed big book sponsor, one that does not honk at people in traffic or yell at people in traffic, but no, if you have a good sponsor, I do have a good one. If you have one, you have to know that you need to check with this person before you do something. If you have been kissing Sally, and Sally is married to Fred, you do not have the right to knock on Fred's door and say, "Fred, I've been kissing your wife Sally, and I'm sorry, and I promise I won't do it anymore." You know how you make amends to Fred? You stop kissing his wife. You stop the behavior. To amend means to change. It means to change. Now, how do I make amends to my mother? How do I make amends to my father? By doing the things that I know they would want me to do relative to my program. By coming here. By walking in the morning with my dog. By doing my swimming. By being a good person. I feel them with me now, and I feel them with me when I'm done walking in the morning. I feel them with me when I conduct myself like a mensch. A mensch is a decent person. I feel them with me when I do things that are good, and I don't do things today to shame them or to hurt them. If I could have hurt my mother, I would have hurt my mother. My greatest joy in life was her misery, and I did many, many things to myself to hurt her, and I ate railroad cars full of Kit Kat bars and Doritos and Raisinets so that it would hurt her and make her cry. I don't engage in those behaviors anymore that will make her cry. I engage in behavior years that would make her happy. And now I feel when she's happy that I can be happy and we can be on the same page. And that's how I make amends. But you need guidance. If you have financial amends, you still need guidance. If you have sexual amends, you still need guidance. Now it says we don't make amends if it will injure them or someone else. It doesn't say anything about you. And you test God. You find where you can test God is in these money amends. Pay the money back. If you can't pay it all at once, pay it out. God will provide for you. And there were some amends that got by me. I forgot about them. And it was no longer my money, but it was our money because I was married at that time. And I explained to my then wife what I needed to embark on. And she didn't miss a beat. She says, go and make the amends. I would rather be missing the money than be missing a husband because I don't want you to die in the food. So she understood and she supported what I was doing. See if you can test God enough to find Him lacking. I bet you cannot do it. Now, is it any wonder that the so-called promises on page 83 come after step 9, after these amends? And as you're making these amends, as we're going to cover tomorrow morning, you start doing 10, 11, you start doing them every single day. Because we're going to talk a lot about step 10 tomorrow, and it says, we rigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Because as you're doing these things, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you're going to have anger come up. You're going to have fear, selfishness, self-seeking, and dishonesty come up. You start doing 10 and 11 every day. You know how they say do the steps and do them in order, but you have to do 10 and 11 before you're at 10 or before you're done with 9. You have to start doing these things or you're just dieting with food support. And if you're dieting with food support, it's not a question of if you're going to eat, it's a question of when. So let's go to page 83, we'll do the promises, and then we'll be done with this part of it for the night. And tomorrow morning, we're going to discuss 10, 11, and 12. Let's go to the bottom of 83. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. Very good. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we think about them, pray for them. No, if we work for them. Okay, if we work for them. Okay. Now, we've talked about the first 9 steps, and tomorrow morning we're going to talk about 10, 11, and 12. But for right now, how much time do we have, by the way? What's our schedule like for tonight? 9:30. Okay. Oh, we have an hour and 5 minutes. Okay. Do you want to record the Q&A or do you want to record sharing? Whatever you want to do. I don't know. Whatever. Okay. I can't. Sometimes you're like saying things and they're not. Phrase it in the form of a question. You don't get the point. You don't have to make a question. You don't have to ask a question, though. You can just share if you choose to share. If someone behind me raises their hand and I can't see it, help me out over here, okay? I saw a hand over here somewhere. Yes?
Hi. I'm Dave Paul. I'm over here.
Hi, Dave.
My name is Dane.
Dane.
And I'm thinking about, you know, like you said at some point you were talking about a sponsor who doesn't have knowledge or can't explain the connection between, and I was thinking between, you know, the working in steps and an awakening or something. I'm trying to figure out what the connection is, and then I was telling myself, you probably said that when we work the steps, it just comes.
Yes, it does. The question, I guess, is what's the connection between the steps and the spiritual awakening? When you take the action, the spiritual awakening will come.
And the other thing was what you were saying about the sponsors. Most sponsors are knowledgeable enough to explain the connection between something.
Spirituality and not wanting to eat or something? I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. If it comes back to you, Dane, raise your hand. Okay, yes. Alejandro.
I guess in some instances it becomes clear when you can make direct amends as opposed to living amends. And it seems like in most of the clear-cut cases that the living amends are the indirect, I guess, living amends are made, you're going to be hurting somebody else if you made the direct amends. In my case, I wanted to know if I had done the right thing by... I'm a teacher. I'm a high school teacher. And there are scores of kids out there that in the past 15 years I've been a total dick to.
And you've been what?
I'm a high school teacher.
Okay.
And
you're a high school teacher. Okay.
And I've been teaching for 15 years. And yeah. I've been a total dick to a lot of kids. Mm-hmm. I've extinguished the love of learning and the curiosity in a lot of kids. And I don't feel proud about that. But I can't go back and track all these kids down and apologize, one by
then
one.
And stop being a dick to the kids.
Exactly.
Being a dick to the kids, and that's how you make your living amends.
That's what I've been trying
to do. If you can't find them, there's nothing you can do. You just cease the behavior and you amend the behavior. There's the word amend. Amend means to change. If we continue, that's not amends. Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Yeah, it has to do with a question I had asked earlier about finding people through 12-step. And the question that I have...
Finding people to 12-step or finding people to make amends to?
No, finding people to 12-step. That's kind of a question that came up when you told the story. I'm not sure what the fellow's name was, where he's in the hospital, he's been called there.
Yes.
And when you relate that to the story of Dr. Bob Bill going to the hospitals and finding people in the drunk tank and finding them in that condition, it seems to be, the question came to my mind, it seems to be a difference between people... who would be in a drunk tank, so we deal with an alcohol issue, versus people that are in hospital because of gross obesity.
Uh-huh.
And people that I've known that fit in that category in the overheating capacity, there seems to be some difference in personality type or whatever. And my question to you is, have you noticed that kind of a difference? I mean, as far as the possibility of being successful with compulsive overeater.
I don't know. The question is, have I noticed the difference between people in the drunk tank and people that are obese in the hospital?
Yes, right.
I don't have a lot of experience. I'm not an alcoholic,
right.
So I've never made a 12-step call in AA. So I don't really have any information with which to go on. I didn't want to be in that hospital.
Right.
I knew that it was the wrong thing to do. We were going there because someone else thought it was a good idea, and I wasn't driving the car, so there really wasn't much I could do. And I explained to the person driving the car, we are not making a 12-step call. We are intruding on this person's privacy. They didn't ask us to come there. He didn't want us there. We are not making a 12-step call. We are intruding on their privacy, and he had a crap in the bed to get rid of us. And we shouldn't have been there in the first place. But I don't know how to answer your question because I don't have experience making 12-step calls to hospitals in AA as I am not an alcoholic. Okay. Yes?
So I'm a year into the program, and I've sponsored quite a few gentlemen who appear to have a lot of momentum initially.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I really appreciated you talking about step two, because I didn't really see it as that critical of a step for certain sponsees.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my question is, initially they have a lot of momentum, but then they some of them begin to lose their momentum and not work the steps
mm-hmm.
in a way we agree to.
Mm-hmm. They have a name for that.
Yeah.
It's called normal. It's called, that's the way it is.
So my question is, like, to what level do you keep...
I don't push them at all. I'm not supposed to push them.
No. So what's your advice? Like, how do you push
my them? Advice is follow chapter 7, and it says if they're not ready, leave them alone. If they're not ready, let them go. And that's my advice, is to read chapter 7 with your sponsor and go over Lord Chapter 7, Working with Others. This is not a program for people who need it. It's not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. And if these people are not willing to work the steps, leave them alone.
So how do you let them go?
Bye.
Got it.
How do I let it, how, you're going to leave here tomorrow?
Yeah.
You're going to go, well, okay. What are you going to do? You're just going to leave, right? Same thing. You may spoil a future chance. And when they're ready, they'll come back or they won't. If they're not ready, you can't say the right thing. If they are ready, you can't say the wrong thing. You cannot make them recover if they don't want to. And you cannot keep them from recovering if they want to. And this is what happens. They come in, and a lot of times they're full of piss and vinegar, and then they fade away. It happens. Dr. Bob was a far better sponsor than Bill. And one of the reasons Dr. Bob was a far better sponsor than Bill was, he wouldn't just take you because you needed the program. He took you if you wanted the program. He told Clarence, and he told some of these guys, well, 66% of the stories in the Pioneer section of the back of the book of AA are from Akron, not from New York. And Bill Wilson came into his apartment one day. Well, get sticking with Bill, with Bob, rather. If these guys weren't ready, and he didn't get the answers he wanted, he just left you alone. And that's exactly what I do. But the bottom line is, Bill came into his apartment one day, and Bill was very enthusiastic. He had a lot of energy, and he'd been pulling these guys off the bar stools in the Bowery in New York City. And he comes in, and none of them are getting sober, and he walks in, and he says to Lois, he says, whoa, this does not work. I thought that I could sober up these people, and I thought that I could really reform these people and give them a better life, and none of them want to get sober. And Lois Wilson turned around and changed the course of the world when she said to him, but you're staying sober. And he said, oh yeah. And for the very first time in his life, that's why alcoholics have a bald spot right up here. But he realized that for the first time in his adult life that he was staying sober. And the most important thing that happened in you working with these people, did you stay abstinent throughout that period of time?
Definitely.
And it worked 100%. It worked 100%. Anything else? Anybody else? I feel like I'm bending again at Wrigley Field. Anybody else? Yes.
Amends. I hear a lot of things that, and me, which I believe is making amends to myself.
Yes.
And so what? So
making amends to myself for me means I work the program and I stay out of the Kit Kat bars, I stay out of the food, and I like who I am today for the only time in my life. I like who I am because it's not just about me, me, me. It's about you, you, you. And when I do self-esteemable acts and self-esteemable things, it really makes me feel good about me. And every day of my life, I say and I write on, my real purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. And I also say helping others is the foundation stone of my recovery. And I also say that service to others is a huge part of my life today. And I get calls from all over the place. I can't count the number of calls that are on this phone since I've been talking tonight, from Colorado, from God knows Florida, from Chicago. And I will return a lot of those calls tomorrow from the airport, and I'll return some of them tonight, some depending on when we get out of here, tomorrow, whatever it is. And I feel good about myself. I feel very good about myself. That's how I make amends to me. I swim every day. I walk every day. I do the very best I can. That's how I make amends to myself. And every single day, unless I'm sick or unless there's some extenuating circumstance, I get my ass to a meeting. I get my ass to where there's people in that are in a meeting where I can be of some service. Next. Anything? Does somebody want to share? Somebody anything? Because we heard some things about sharing. So this is your time. Yes, Alejandro.
How do you know, I guess a purple question for you, how do you know when is best to think of others first and when it's best to take care of yourself first?
you really know this internally. There's an internal signal that comes up from within you when it's time to take care of you and when it's time to take care of others. When in doubt, take care of others. But if you really feel like you need some me time, take it. Because, if, you know, on every airplane is a great element on meeting. They say, put your mask on first. Put your mask on first. If you have nothing to give, you have nothing to give.
You put it over your lawyer first.
You put it over your lawyer first? Okay. All right, if your lawyer happens to be on the plane, put it over him first.
Okay.
All right. Yes.
I'm John, alcoholic and compulsive reader.
You don't.
And following up a little bit on what Gene was asking you about people who kind of wish they wanted to work enough to actually work. I've had occasions when people would call me on a regular basis, but they wouldn't be really willing to put in the effort, either for abstinence or for doing the steps, but they kept calling and they kept wanting to come to meetings, and I was hoping so much that I could at least inspire them and help them along to the point where they caught fire. And yet a part of me feels like I ought to say, look, if you're not going to do the work, don't bother me.
Why don't you say that?
And another part of me wants to continue to talk to them.
You think you're doing them any favors by giving them a credential? You're not. What they're doing is they're calling you for a membership card. I have a sponsor, I call my sponsor, and I go to meetings. But they're not working the program. You're not doing them any favors. You're really not doing them any favors. And I suggest, again, reread Chapter 7 with somebody that knows the book, that knows the program. Reread Chapter 7. It's very clear. If they don't want to do the work, leave them alone. When their sobriety becomes more important to you than it is to them, that is the Al-Anonic condition in its active form. That is the Al-Anonic condition in its raw, active form. Len.
Thanks, Len, compulsive reader. My wife is 10 years younger than me, and she's very, very sharp.
Nice work.
So that's what they say. Anyway, she's very sharp, and I've retired, and my memory is not as good. The bottom line is, I find myself depending more on my wife for a lot of things, a lot of little things that ultimately are big things. And I worry that my wife is becoming more and more of a higher power. Because as I become older and she's still pretty active, I find that, boy, you know, she's going to watch over me, or she's going to say, don't eat that dessert, or she's going to say, you know, let's go this there. And I begin to wonder, who is my higher power, God or my wife?
Well, therein lies the question, therein lies the answer. So if you think she's your higher power, she probably is. And the best piece of advice I can give you is this. That would be for me. I've been there and I've done that, and I'm a single man to prove it. Anybody that has a higher power with skin, be they male or female, is asking for trouble. When I start being too dependent on another person, that is trouble. Because love and respect are Siamese twins, and they cannot be separated. The minute somebody loses respect for me, then they cannot love me. They just can't. Love and respect are Siamese twins that cannot be separated. Behind me, John.
I can run maybe some graph I saw this, but remember a while back where it was a phrase that said in the big book or one of the 12 laws of AA, it would say, extend the olive branch, but don't put it in your hand.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
In other words, what the idea was is that when doing this, if we put it in the hand, we drag ourselves back into the disease.
Yep. So much. Sounds good.
You know what I mean? But preference to what Don was saying over there is like, in other words, I would put it to say, you know what, I'm only going to go to a certain point because I still got to take care of me. You know, and if I continue to kind of see this person, well, you know, want to get involved and do the steps, you know, I'm going to lose me. I'm not being helpful to myself. Correct?
Correct. Correct. That's why the big book is very clear. If they don't want to do the work, leave them alone.
Okay.
Leave them alone. I'll teach you a Yiddish expression. Losen gain means leave them alone. They'll either, the food will convince them a lot more than you will to come back. The food will beat their asses back in here, or the food will kill them. One way or the other. And it has nothing to do with you. We had to quit playing God. It simply did not work. But if there, I'm going to repeat this again so you know. I'm not plugging another fellowship. If their sobriety, their abstinence is more important to you than it is to them, that is the Al-Anonic condition in its active form. That is Al-Anonic illness in its active form. Yes?
Hi. So it's well, I'll cut to the chase. We had a really good dinner tonight. Okay, the food here is wonderful. And as soon as I was walking through the line, I saw the carrot cake. And as I shared, I'm diabetic. And I know I'm not supposed to eat that carrot cake. And I decided, okay, they were little squares, so maybe if I just had one of those little squares. So I saved that to the end of the meal. And after I finished, I said, well, that was a really little square. I could have another one. And somebody said, get one for me, too. So I went and got two, gave him one, I had one. Figured, well, I'm giving him one. Okay? And I had the second piece of carrot cake. I was supposed to have one. So I'm saying, what's your advice when you're faced with that? It really sounds like step one, powerless, you know.
I wish I had some advice to give you. The only thing I can tell you is, how badly do you want the carrot cake? And are you willing to reach out? You're at a retreat in a room full of men that would have done anything for you not to eat that carrot cake, and you chose to eat it. There's nothing we can do. We're just going to get out of your way. And when you're done with that carrot cake, when you've had your fill of carrot cake, you'll either come back in here with your tail between your legs, or you'll die. But you know what I can do to stop you from eating carrot cake? Nothing. Nothing. You squash me like a bug to get a carrot cake. And how do I know that? Because I would squash you like a bug to get a carrot cake. If I wanted that carrot cake, are you kidding me? There's nothing we can do. We will be here and we'll keep the light on for you. When that day comes where you want recovery more than you want carrot cake, but while you want to eat carrot cake, we're just going to wish you well and love the crap out of you. We're going to love you, and we're going to keep the light on for you, and we're going to hope that God will see fit to bring you back to us in one piece.
Okay, I got one.
Yes?
So define resentment again.
Resentment, to re-feel old hurts, old pains, old injuries. To re-feel. Resent means to re-feel, to do again. That's what a resentment is.
What if you get like a resentment, like intense resentments, and then it's like the next week you don't have any? It's like, is that like a growth period?
No, it just means you've got something else to focus on for that week. You may have other resentments to focus on. I have a resentment against Bob back there. Yes. But sometimes I have a resentment against Lynn. Sometimes I have a resentment against John. Sometimes I have a resentment against the other. So maybe while I'm resenting Lynn over here, I'm not resenting Bob, but I still have the resentment against Bob, and then sometimes I'm going to have a resentment against Victor, so I'm not thinking about Lynn. It's all the same poison, it's just got a different thing. One's live, one's bleach, one's Drano. They'll all kill you.
Isn't that normal?
Yeah, it's very normal. Is there a question there? Or? Okay, all right, I hope I answered it. Okay, yes, Lynn.
So, to piggyback on the resentment question, if you're working a fourth step or a fifth step with your sponsor, I had a sponsee who came down to resentment, and then he had resentment against me.
He shouldn't have been giving you his fifth step because you're informed, you're not uninvolved. He should never have been giving you his fifth step. There is nothing in the big book that says you must give your sponsor your fifth step. You choose somebody, it does not have to be your sponsor. That should never have happened.
How would you handle that if one of your sponsees?
Give that resentment to someone else. I've had it happen many times in the past because I have a tendency to piss people off. Just ask the lady in San Diego. You know, it'd be that time. But the bottom line is.
Oh, there you are.
That's it. See, now, I have some work to do too. But he should have never given you his fifth step. He should have given that resentment to someone else. Yes, he should have never done that. Is that it? Going once. Going twice.
Can I go on something?
You can go again, yes.
Okay. I want to thank you for something. When you first, now this is too personal, I'm going to shut up on topic, but when you first mentioned about your wife and your divorce and so forth, that's the fear. I've been married 42 years, and for a good many of those years, I've been afraid my wife will leave me. And I think she also shares that fear. And
she fears she'll leave you or you'll leave her?
God might leave her.
Okay.
I think we've gotten past that point for the most part. We've been together so long. We haven't done it now. We're never going to do it. But it's still there. And I hear, you got together. You're our leader. Okay? I'm thinking, wow, his wife all of a sudden falls in love with someone, leaves. That could happen to me too. And then you kind of explain all the situation you let up. And I have issues, but my issues were different than your issues. Okay? So I'm thinking, okay, these are issues. And I felt a little better for it. So I just wanted to go ahead and help you a little bit. Okay?
Okay. All right. Thanks. Is there a question there? Or?
No, I just
wanted to be sure. Okay, no problem. That's fine. Just wanted to be sure because I don't want to leave a question ignored or unanswered if I can answer it. Only once?
Nope.
Don.
Yeah. Hi, Don, compulsive overeater.
I know.
I know over the last couple years in my life, I have been able to establish by using the steps graciously through a lot of people who helped me in the program and primarily my sponsor of about 4 or 5 years to have a better relationship with God than I ever had before. My life has gotten incredibly better only because of that. But there are times, and I know when it starts to happen, when the things that I do that keep that relationship really, really cooking and strong, I start changing things. Things that I used to do as a pattern. Every day, this is what I do. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And all of a sudden, I start doing 1, 2. And then sometimes 3, and I get out, And I've come to the conclusion that the best way for me to get that cooking again is to start doing service that I never did before, going to more meetings. But I wanted to get your tag that should that happen to you, where you feel you're sort of, did I go away or did God go away, How do you handle that in your life?
I've had situations where my 11-step prayers in the morning have become very rote. I'm saying the same things over and over again, and I'm praying the same prayers over and over again, and I'm thinking about ESPN, or I'm thinking about girls, or I'm thinking about money, and I'm not thinking about God. I'm just going through it like you would an exercise. I'm just going through it like you would something that you were doing for homework. And sometimes I have to shake it up, and I have to say to myself, stop, and really give this the determined attention that it needs. You're communicating with your higher power, and sometimes I have to change the prayers I say, and sometimes I have to change the things I do, and I have to change my meditations around because it gets to be too routine and I'm not really appreciating it. And I do a gratitude list every single day, and I look around and I thank God for the big book, and I thank God for the first 100, and I thank God for the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, and I thank God for all the hard work Roseanne did to start all that. And I thank God for AG, and I thank God for all the various people that made it possible for us to have this program. Because this is something that didn't just happen. This retreat didn't just spring up like a weed in the garden. There's work that's involved. There's promotions. They started promoting this that I'm aware of. Last year at the OA birthday in Los Angeles, I saw Dave, and what does he... If you see him at the OA birthday, and you see him in January, at the end of January, and I'm going to be there, God willing, and I hope you will be there too, because that's a hell of a celebration. He's going to have his hat on, and he's going to have in his hand flyers. and the flyers that he's going to have, he's going to hand to every man that he sees at the LAX Hilton, and every man is going to get a flyer for the men's retreat next year here. Now, some of the men will toss it away. Some of the men won't pay attention to it. Some of the men are not here now. But maybe some of you are here because he started the ball going. And then he got the registration going. And it's the same thing with program. I have to be grateful for the people who walked before me. But if I'm not careful, that prayer time, that meditation time in the morning could be like doing a math problem. I'm done with it, and I'm moving on to other things. I have to make sure that I give it the attention it deserves.
I have a question.
Yes.
Yeah, based on your experience in history of beginning of AA and all that, Bill Wilson, I've heard people comment about derogatorily about Bill Wilson and, you know, how he had this attitude and wanted to make money with his.
Bill Wilson was very human.
No, and that's my point. I mean, and I've heard you comment before at other times about how at that moment in time in history, that personality was needed to take this to.
Yes, it was. God knew who to choose, and he chose a guy that was cunning, dappling, and powerful too. Did Bill have his dalliances? Did Bill have his problems? Absolutely he did. He was very human. But look at what he accomplished in his life. Look at what he did. Forget about what he was. Look at what he did. And he changed the world that he lived in. So did Roseanne. So did Jim Willis, who founded Gamblers Anonymous. So did the people that walked before us. All the people that walked before you. We're going to talk about this tomorrow. We're going to talk about Roseanne. And we're going to talk about A.G. Ainsworth. And we're going to talk about Jim Willis. And we're going to talk about, you know, Bill and Bob and all these various other people and the first 100. Every one of them had one thing in common. They were human beings. And as human beings, they had ups and they had downs and they had pluses and minuses. But look at what they did. Yes?
A while back when I first started the firm, there was a icon of a pyramid. Okay.
There wasn't a pyramid. It was a triangle encased in a circle.
Okay.
Recovery, okay. Service, Fellowship.
Right.
And when they lost the rights to the first edition of the book, they took it out. AA, somebody effed up over there. They lost the copyright on the first edition. But if you look at what, if I sponsor you, one of the first things we're going to do is we're going to take that and we're going to draw it in ink. And I don't know if you can see this, but we draw that in ink if I sponsor you. And the bottom of the triangle is recovery, because everything rests on recovery. And then it says unity on the left and service on the right. But the triangle are the three principles of recovery, service, and unity. And the circle represents a never-ending recovery. That we pray without ceasing, and we work steps unceasingly. We keep working the steps every day of our lives that we never stop.
The thing I want to ask
you, okay.
Right now, Carolyn, our hair group is really struggling to an issue about service, or getting people to want to do service.
Just your inner group? Trust me, you're not alone there.
But in general, without trying to promote it, but instead keeping with the tradition of attraction, that's what our program is, attraction. What is the purpose or reason to want to encourage service? Or what purpose of telling a newcomer service is part of it? What is it? What are the benefits? How do I express?
Do you have a gun? Bring it and carry it. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. You're not always going to inspire them. A lot of them don't care. A lot of them don't give a crap. And some of them will do service. You just keep encouraging them and you keep getting involved in doing service and show them what it does for you. Tell them about what doing service does for you. There's always three things you can do to solve any problem within OA. You can recover, recover, and recover. And when you recover, you show people what this does for you. If you're not in recovery and you're not showing them anything, you're not motivating them to do a damn thing. But even when you're in recovery, I know from being outside now, the first 8 or 9 years I lived in Scottsdale, I was an intergroup rep for the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club. And I used to have goals every third Saturday of the month. And he knows my goals. I used to say, I will not be on the news. I will not go to jail. I will not be the object of a SWAT team investigation or operation. I mean, it gets hairy at intergroup in Phoenix. It really does. And we're supposed to have a meeting that begins at 1 and ends at 3. There were times we didn't walk out of there until 4:30 in the afternoon. Why? Over nothing. We don't have the money to send 5 delegates to the World Service, so we're only going to send 3. Okay, now the fight is on. Should we send 5 anyway? Should we tap into the proof reserve? What should we do? I said, if you're looking for a free trip to Albuquerque on the intergroup, please get off the board. Please get off the board. So, you know, these are the kind of things. You want to inspire them? Show them what it does for you. Recover, recover, and recover. And not all of them are going to jump on it either. Going. Going. Gone. We'll see you tomorrow morning.